This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
I think it's highly conceivable that if the U.S. decides we're going to fully suspend military aid or even partially suspend aid, that Russia could fill in that gap very easily.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, on why the U.S. should pursue EU support in pressing Tunisia to return to a path towards democracy. Details coming up. Also, heavy fighting is raging in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll have these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. 11 newborn babies died in a hospital blaze in the western Senegalese city of Tivaouen. The French news agency AFP, quoting Health Minister Abdoulaye Diouf Sarr, said a short circuit sparked the fire at Mame Abdou Aziz Said Dabak Hospital and the transport hub of Tivaouen. The new inaugurated hospital's maternity unit was equipped to take care of 13 babies. At the time of the fire, there was 11 whom nurses were unable to save, but according to the mayor, Demba Diop, 3 babies were saved. President Macky Sall expressed his condolences to the families of the babies who died. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus tweeted that he was beyond heartbroken with this tragic news. The tragedy comes after several other incidents at public health facilities in Senegal, where there is great disparity between urban and rural areas in healthcare services. Heavy fighting raged in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo today between the army and M23 rebels. The militants briefly captured an army base in Rumangambo, but a few hours later the army retook it. The rebels, however, control much of the surrounding area. There was also heavy fighting overnight near the town of Kibumba, about 20 kilometers northeast of Goma, near the border with Rwanda. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti passed through the town yesterday and reported seeing dead bodies on the streets. Al-Katanti and 2 colleagues at one point were caught in a heavy battle between the M23 and the army. The M23 insurgency stems from the long fallout from the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. The group's leadership is from the Tutsi ethnic group and has justified its attacks by saying it is battling the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, FDLR, a militia founded by ethnic Hutus who fled Rwanda after participating in the genocide. South Africa's ruling African National Congress, the ANC, has acknowledged in a document leaked to the media that it is facing defeat in the next election in 2024. The ANC has been in power since Nelson Mandela became president following the country's first multiracial polls in 1994. However, after a promising start, South Africa has lurched from crisis to crisis. Darren Taylor has more.
Violent crimes rampant in South Africa, which has some of the world's highest murder, rape and armed robbery rates, along with the highest unemployment rate in the world at almost 40%. Corruption and mismanagement have eroded state-owned enterprises to the point where many barely function. National power company Eskom, for example, is imposing more and longer electricity blackouts. With so much baggage, the ANC's hanging on to power by a thread, as shown by its loss of 6 out of South Africa's 8 major cities after local government elections last year. The ANC isn't disputing the authenticity of the document, leaked to several Johannesburg media outlets. It was reportedly written by party leaders, including the president, for debate at an ANC leadership meeting in July. ANC spokespeople have said at several media briefings that the ruling party remains confident it'll solve its problems soon. Director of Johannesburg's Center for Risk Analysis, John Endres, says the document displays rare honesty from ruling party leaders.
And it says that based on current modeling and trajectories, they are going to drop below 50% come 2024. And we think they're probably right within that assessment.
He says while the ANC blames the COVID-19 pandemic for creating a depressed national mood that's contributed to its woes, its leaders are identifying factors that seem to be heralding its downfall.
They then mention the devastated economy and joblessness, the increase in poverty and hunger, the July unrest, social dislocation, distrust of government, of course, here really taking aim at themselves, enormous service delivery failures, including in water and electricity, corruption allegations, leadership conflicts, weak and non-existent party primary structures, and also financial problems within the party.
It's clear from this, says the analyst, that the ANC is convinced by its election losses that it's self-destructing.
What they rightly observe is that three of those metros are the only three metros in Gauteng, and that really represents the economic heartland of South Africa, where much of the economic output is generated. And they also write that this loss of the Gauteng metros has rendered ANC leadership of the Gauteng province almost hollow.
In the paper, ANC leader and current president Cyril Ramaphosa mentions three steps to address his party's flagging fortunes: revitalizing ANC structures by ending party infighting, regaining public trust by building a capable and ethical state, and advancing the ideals of the National Democratic Revolution by, for example, putting more of the economy in the hands of the black majority. These steps, says Endres, have been proclaimed by the ANC since 1994 and have never happened.
Our assessment is that this is probably as good as it's going to get in terms of idea development. If there's not anything else forthcoming, then we do not see any change in the ANC's trajectory. And they are inevitably going to drop further because the outcomes they are producing for South Africans are not going to improve on the basis of the policies and ideology they are pursuing at the moment.
Former President Jacob Zuma once said the ANC would rule South Africa until Jesus returns. Well, says Endres, the party is going to have to be miraculously resurrected if Zuma's prediction is to hold. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The U.S. has committed to working closely with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation on critical issues, including building resilience to climate change and ensuring food security for the most vulnerable populations. The commitment came during 2 days of talks in Washington, which also focused on the COVID-19 pandemic, human rights, food security, violent extremism, threats to freedom of expression. The U.S. says it emphasized the importance of ensuring that women and persons with disabilities are included in decision-making processes as they have been disproportionately affected by climate change and COVID-19. The U.S. State Department said the U.S. was encouraged by common ground found on the importance of community engagement, building resilience to recruitment and radicalization by terrorist organizations, especially ISIS-Daesh and Al-Qaeda, and supporting the role of education in countering violent extremism. 10 months have passed since Tunisian President Kais Saied blocked parliament with tanks, then suspended the constitution and dissolved the Supreme Judicial Council. Saied has since seized control of the Independent Electoral Commission, allowing him to consolidate power. Experts in Tunisia are urging the U.S. and the European Union to do something drastic to restore democracy there within 2 months. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Shalawi has the details.
Tunisia, a country that until recently offered one of the best hopes of democratization in the Middle East, has been going through a slide back to an autocratic rule since the president's coup of July 25, 2021. Now President Saied is preparing to organize a referendum on July 25th on an undisclosed constitution to be written by a committee of five or six people appointed solely by the president. followed by a national dialogue excluding existing political parties. While the world is focusing its attention on developments in Ukraine, experts on Tunisia stress that the current crisis in Tunisia offers an opportunity for the US and the European Union to send a powerful signal in defense of democratic values. In late March, the State Department proposed to cut both military and economic assistance to Tunisia by almost half. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also made it clear that the aid would not be restored unless Saeed pursues a transparent, inclusive, to include political parties, labor and civil society reform process. Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, has doubts about the end results of such a move.
I think it's highly conceivable that if the U.S. decides we're going to fully suspend military aid or even partially suspend aid, that Russia could fill in that gap very easily. Again, the amounts are not that big. That would take away the U.S. leverage they have with the military. There's also reports that Saeed has been asking President Sisi to pressure the Gulf to give Tunisia assistance.
She said no matter what needs to be done, if there were ever a time for the international community to act, it would be now, before Saeed succeeds in consolidating power and ending Tunisian democracy entirely using the July 25 referendum. Saeed has been negotiating with the International Monetary Fund over a multi-billion dollar bailout that would save Tunisia from a looming default. Such a loan would likely require Tunisia to first develop a plan for reforms to tackle subsidies, the high public sector wage bill, and loss-making state companies. Shari Hamid is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy. He believes that leveraging U.S. aid alone is unlikely to be enough. The United States, in coordination with European partners, must consider something it has rarely done. He calls it the maximal option.
It's using the IMF talks as our primary lever. The U.S. and its European partners are the largest shareholders in the IMF, meaning that they can use their voting rights to compel IMF officials to suspend talks. That is not unrealistic. It's not implausible. It's 100% plausible. All you need is political will.
Hamid said this might be the best and last chance at pressuring Saeed to change course. With the economy in free fall, the IMF loan is important to Tunisia not only as a stopgap to fund the state budget, but also as a signal to improve its credit to obtain other loans. Larry Diamond, director of the Center on Democracy, Development and Rule of Law at Stanford University, suggests a middle road for the U.S. and the European Union to convince the Tunisian president that restoring democracy is better for him and for the country.
It's carrots and sticks. And here I would send a high-level envoy to Saeed. If that person could be accompanied by someone from the EU or an EU partner, even better. But I think we should lay out to Saeed everything we're willing to do to help and elevate Tunisia and make him a successful president for the remainder of his term.
Diamond suggests some carrots, such as telling Saeed it will help him get re-elected again if he does specific democratic things, but also making very clear to him what's going to happen if he goes down the current path. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Firefighters have contained a large blaze that erupted in a cargo area of the Sudanese Red Sea port of Suakin. The fire, which raged for hours, broke out in the cargo drop-off area port yesterday, sending plumes of acid smoke into the sky. It was not immediately clear what caused the blaze. The French news agency AFP quoted port director Taha Ahmed Mokhtar as saying today that the fire has been brought under control following the intervention of civil defense forces and port workers. He said an investigation will look into the cause of the fire and a commission will assess the losses. A port official who spoke on condition of anonymity earlier described the damage as catastrophic. The blaze came as Sudan is gripped by a chronic economic crisis, which deepened after last year's military coup. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. As worries mount about food shortages due to the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict, Egypt, the world's largest importer of wheat, says it is preparing a series of agricultural projects to help curb food imports and provide increasingly for the domestic market in a sustainable fashion. The projects, which are part of the Egyptian government's efforts to improve agricultural output by 2030, have been in development for several years. Edward Yeranian reports from Cairo.
Egyptian leaders recently announced the country is in the process of developing a series of agricultural projects that will increase domestic output and decrease reliance on imports of foreign agricultural products. At the inauguration of one of the new projects, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said water usage is a major issue in increasing production, but he said the government has found solutions to the problem. The president said Egypt is getting the water from several main sources. Some water is coming from wells, while some is coming from agricultural treatment plants that will purify the water according to WHO standards. None of the water for this project is coming from the Nile River, he adds. The project director, Bahal Ghanem, says that it will be carried out in four phases, noting that a special focus is being put on wheat production, given projected international wheat shortages due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. He says that Egypt imported $8 billion worth of wheat, corn and soybeans in 2021, but that the agricultural projects being built will help reduce imports and alleviate any crisis resulting from the Russia-Ukraine conflict or COVID-19. Wheat cultivation, he adds, is due to increase from 40,000 acres this year to 120,000 in 2023. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA Egypt will overcome wheat shortages by producing more wheat and diversifying its imports, but that there could be potential problems in 2023 if the Ukraine conflict continues and climate change affects wheat-producing countries. Sadiq points out that some North African countries like Algeria buy their wheat from Russia and are less likely to have a shortage. Morocco, on the other hand, he says, is having climate problems which could affect production. Ahmed Abu Yazid, a professor at Ain Shams University's Agricultural College, told Egyptian TV the government is implementing a strategy of developing all the infrastructure for the new agricultural projects, including water and electricity. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that the new Daba agricultural project, located between Giza and Alexandria, will increase cultivation of wheat, potatoes, sugar beets, and sunflower oil, along with other vegetables. Paul Sullivan, a Middle East analyst at the Atlantic Council, says countries like Egypt could conceivably increase production.
There's always hope for increasing agricultural output, but it would be best to have land and water efficient crops. But hybrid varieties that can prosper in hotter, drier weather would also help.
Sullivan argues that the Egyptian government will do what it can to alleviate any shortages, but that may not keep food inflation at bay given the world's wheat situation. He blames Russia for preventing wheat from leaving Ukraine and the Black Sea as the main culprit for wheat prices and shortages in the world. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Rwandan government has released over 700 former troops who fled long ago to the Democratic Republic of Congo and became insurgents against their native country. They were forcefully repatriated following a pledge by the DRC to oust forces that destabilize security in the Eastern African community. Eugene Umana has more details from Kigali.
A total of 735 former combatants, including 30 senior officers, were discharged from the Mutobo Demobilization and Reintegration Center in northern Rwanda. They were captured in forest areas by the Congolese army after spending more than 2 decades fighting to seize Rwanda. Colonel Joseph Gatabazi explains the process. He says the Congolese army heavily fired on them while they were camped in eastern DRC. He says they fled and scattered until all captured and taken by cars to Rwanda. He says many were afraid to arrive in the country that they spent so long trying to destabilize. These former combatants are being discharged after 2 years of civic education and vocational training. Some are meeting relatives who they have not seen for 26 years. Others don't remember the names of their native villages. This man says he and his family fled when he was 5, and his parents died a long time ago, and he doesn't remember his origin. He says he hopes the government can help him resettle. The repatriations were the result of a number of Congolese military operations. Since the DRC joined the East African Community, EAC, in March, many joint operations have been carried out to weaken what they call negative forces in the eastern DRC. After proving the DRC's admission into the EAC, Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu said member countries will finally be able to exploit untapped opportunities.
We all know the importance of DRC joining our community, as all partner states have long and close cooperation by either bordering or having trade relationship, which will enhance prosperity of our people and the region.
The UN peacekeeping mission MONUSCO says more than 100 rebel groups are operating in the forest of the DRC. Leaders say regional integration is an important weapon to neutralize those groups. Since 2001, Rwanda has accepted and demobilized 12,000 former combatants. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Regis Rodriguez, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
The Basketball Africa League is back. Voice of America joins forces with Africa's premier men's basketball league to bring you the second season of the BAL. It is game on March 5th, 2022. 38 games, 12 teams leaving it all on the court in Senegal, Egypt, and Rwanda to determine the 2022 season champion. Tune in to VOA 24/7 FMs and to our radio and TV affiliates for some action. Pre-game, play-by-play, post-game, daily highlights, delivered by our finest commentators. Basketball Africa League 2022 on Voice of America. May the best team win.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturday. Saturdays and Sundays at 1500.